Why, yes. But surely you came hither with intent, did you not?
I came here with no intent, Madame, he said with some severity, for he knew her character only too well, as she knew his, and he mistrusted her motive in seeking him now.
Did you not know, my dear, that this is my chateau, and these my grounds? Surely my friend of old days has come to renew his acquaintance with my hospitality. By the way, I hear you have now a new name, the other was not good enough for the society hereabouts. Well, my dear Paul, come and I will show you my home, and company.
Madame, he said, I distrust you. I have reason, as you will understand, if you will search your memory. That, my friend, I do not choose to do more than I can help. Now and then it is brought back to me, the old life, by such a meeting as this, for example. And while we can meet as old acquaintances, yet I am glad to call you by a new name, it serves to veil the past in some little measure. For which reason I should take it as a kindness, on your part, if you would call me also by the name I bear in this country.
And what is that?
The Countess merely. And now come, and I will do you the honors of my poor home. You will understand, my dear friend, that although the house has some pretension to dignity, both in size and appointment, yet this country is not a rich one and we all have to live in, more or less, shall I say, straitened circumstances.
At any rate, you will see presently, she replied, with a mirthless laugh.
Now come, I will make you known to these friends first. She then hailed those who sat with the others and, with elaborate mannerisms, aping the grand mode of the old nobility, introduced him to each member of the circle as she led him round. They were all dressed in rags, but these were so arranged as to parody the ancient style as near as possible, and the speech and gestures were suited to their assumed characters. But beneath each and every exterior there lay coarseness, sensuality, loutishness, which peeped out and betrayed itself in every word and glance, even in those attitudes which they assumed in their endeavor after some classical and graceful pose. But all this veneer was in vain. The within shone through its outer covering and stood confused. Last of all, he was led to the pedestal and introduced to the performer. On the advent of the Countess, the attention of her audience had been distracted, and she had ceased her posturing. She now sat with her feet dangling from the small platform, elbows on thighs, and hands quietly clasped between her knees, waiting until the ceremony of introduction was over. She was looking intently at him as he approached, as if uncertain of his identity. When he was within 3 yards of the foot of the pillar, she suddenly realized that she was correct in her surmise. She scrambled up, stood for a moment on the platform to gain her balance, and then leapt off her perch, alighting with her heels full in his eyes. The force of her spring bore him to the ground, and, before he could rise, she was down upon him, her knees on his chest and her nails buried in his scalp, as she bit first his ear, then his cheek, using teeth and nails like a frenzied young tiger. The crowd did not interfere. It was to them merely an interlude, quite impromptu, and interesting in its novelty. So they reclined and conversed together, following the details of the fight with a languid interest meant to be polite and dilettante. By and by Paul managed to throw off the girl, and kicked her body some few feet away. Seeing she intended to return and renew the fray, he repeated the operation from time to time until her naked body rolled beyond the circle and down a small slope into a ditch, where she was left to recover alone. The victor of such a contest, it might be thought, would have displayed some sense of shame. Not so. He saw in the faces of his audience what was expected of him and played to their lead. He bowed, as a conquering knight might bow who had met his man in the lists. And they clapped hands daintily, and applauded him victor. The Countess sealed their approval by coming forward and apologizing for the ill manners of the pantomime. She is young, she explained, and ill used to our society. And, she added, with a leer, she once was pretty. Poor thing. She must have mistaken you, my friend, for someone she had met before somewhere sometime, somehow. The three adverbs were spoken with a pause between, each one a poniard of memory plunged into the heart of this newcomer, who strode along by her side with proud and defiant mien. He had won his footing to their respect and deference, and he was determined to maintain it before them all. Meanwhile, the girl lay in the ditch, mud-stained and sobbing in her misery of shame and loneliness. The party had gone, and the twinkling lamps, which had decked the trees, were out. Distressed and wearied with her hardships and her late exertions, she at last fell into a state of coma. Then, in the silence that came out of the darkness, which enshrouded the plain, two figures. One held her left hand raised forward, and on the palm was a globe which emitted a soft golden light. The other followed where she saw the light lead the way until they came and stood over the prostrate form. "Sister and Monica," the leader spoke in sad, quiet tones. "She has suffered enough. The last necessary episode has been played. She has met him, Monica. We will take the poor erring lamb with us and tend her well." She paused and looked wistfully at the form lying there unconscious, and murmured to herself, "Yes, of such is the kingdom, even of such as you, poor fragile flower. You shall have careful tending, sweet soiled lily as you are, and you shall be all white once more, some day." Then she looked up into the blackness above her in silent prayer. And while she prayed, there came speeding through the air a small company of men whose garments were so bright that the gaunt trees of the woods stood out clearly in their rays. They came swiftly and, before Monica could realize what was happening, both she and the girl were taken up and wafted away from the scene. She lost all sense of location. She only saw around her a company of strong, good faces and beautiful forms radiant with light which was all about her, and in which she travelled as in an enclosed pavilion. Wednesday, February 5, 1919. 6 to 7:20 p.m. It is not our intention to pursue the history of Paul as he descended lower into the darkness of the hell world. We have given you enough to indicate, as a signpost, the way he went, and the manner of life there obtaining we have shown you. It is unnecessary and undesirable that we should further analyze its ingredients. They are not savory. It suffices that those who read should have knowledge of the broad outlines of life as it is in those regions of gloom. There are worse and darker realms than that of which we have spoken. Our object is missionary in your world, as our quest has been in this of spirit. If what we have portrayed, eked out by that faculty of imagination which all possess in varying measure, has not deterrent force sufficient, then the reader would not be bettered were we to dilate on the greater wickedness and horror of life in communities of lower grade. For a long season Paul remained in darkness. He went from one evil state to a worse until the limit of his frenzy was bottomed, and then, with much travail and agony, he retraced his steps to that place where Albert awaited his coming. But he came a broken soul, all his arrogance gone, all his pride flattened, tired out with evil doing, despair, a gleam of hope, testing, struggling, backsliding, a flicker of sorrow for his sinfulness, penitence, more of testing and trying, sacrifice and labor and, at last, return to that same dim land from which he had fled, hoping to escape the payment of his debt, the reaping of his sowing. Abject he came, at long last, but of more acceptable temper than that with which he first had come. Then he came from the environment which surrounds and deludes and blinds so many men of talent and riches in the earth life. Now this same man came from the depths of that abyss where he had found his real place in God's great family. He came ready to take the lowliest position at the feet of one whom once he had treated as a spoil sport little to be accounted of. "There are a few questions I would like to ask you, Kathleen, if I may. First, I noticed a difference in the style of the above from that of previous sittings, I think." "That may be so. There is no special reason for any marked difference. Sister is taking rather more part tonight in the actual transmission of the message. That is all." "Why is she doing that?" "While the narrative part was in process of transmission, she had to stand aloof more or less, in order to get en rapport with those conditions by which she came into contact with the events of those darker regions as they stand in our records. P44 She had, as it were, to go there in order that she might, with the help of our little band of workers present here, reproduce in your imagination, or what is sometimes called interior vision, the scenes which we were at the moment describing. That done, She has been able to relax the tension necessary to do that and to turn her mind more wholly on the message itself as it is handed on through us to you. As you seem to be interested in this matter, I will put it in another way. Hitherto her back has been turned to us and we have seen her face in a mirror. It is that reflection we have handed on to you. She has now, for the time being, laid aside the mirror and turned her face our way. We give you now, not the reflection of her countenance, but the picture direct. Or for face you may substitute mind. Do we make our meaning clear, my friend?
Yes, I think you do, Kathleen. But why do you now speak in the plural?
To continue the use of our image of speech, while her back was turned to us, it was necessary that our party distribute the work in hand among themselves. Some looked at the mirror and read it carefully. Their reading they handed on to another section, turned, half of them towards the mirror, and half towards myself. These sent the messages to me and I transmitted it to you. Now we all face towards you, and sister is nearer to you and to us than she has been hitherto, because she has not to go to that spot where the mirror will catch the ray, shall we say the infrared, needful for the reading of the records, in order that they might, in turn, be read by our band from their reproduction in the varying expression of her countenance as seen in the mirror. The mirror shows her the scenes to be described. It shows us her countenance.
Thank you. I understand this, of course, merely as an analogy. But it helps me to understand something of the matter, anyway.
Would you, please, tell me who is she of whom you have spoken as sister? She is identical with the lady who came to the help of Monica and, with Monica, to the rescue of the poor pantomime of whom we told you last night. You are wondering after her proper name. We will call her sister, it will suffice. I see in your mind another question. I will answer it here. She is one who has charge of several rest houses on the borderland between the region of gloom and that of twilight. You might, perhaps, call it the entrance land to the hells, a buffer state, or neutral land, between the depths and the surface, but far away from the summerland withal. Are there in your band some who lived on Earth a long time ago?
No.
You asked that because of the old-fashioned wording which slips through here and there withal, for instance. As a matter of fact, that does not actually come from this side. We are now using what store of words we find in your mind, and that is one which, with others, was left over by your previous communicators, some of whom date their earth life some centuries ago. Leader is one who does so. In the life beyond the veil, Vols. I to V, talking of olden times, why do the people of Madame's Chateau ape the old French nobility?
Me?
Blescom could not have been of those times, for you told me she knew Paul on earth, and he is evidently modern.
That is so.
Sister is taking up the answer in somewhat direct fashion. It is direct through me if that is not a contradiction. It is not many buildings which stand in that dark world for a long time. That chateau is an exception. Those who founded it were what you would say thoroughgoing in their convictions, and they clung to them when they came here. The chateau took on their deportment. Is not that so in your English?
My meaning will be clear, I trust.
So the house stood firm when many who had founded it, and laid out its demesne, had departed, some up and a lesser some down. New people come continually. Some pass by. It is not to their liking. Some stay and inhabit.
Very well.
Years pass and the old fashion still remains, but lingers, dragging along. As told in the Book of Franchezzo, the once grand castles are only as ruined copies on the low astral. Chapter 4, In the Grey Lands, Thursday, February 6, 1919, 5.45 to 6.40 p.m., at the foot of the hills which may be viewed from the borderland between the regions of gloom and of the twilight, there is a recess. It runs into the range a little to the right of the cleft through which the valley finds exit into the brighter plain beyond. In this recess there grow large ferns and coniferous trees, not very large, but of more comely aspect than those in the Netherlands. Bracken also grows there and, after journeying through those tracts of gloom of which we have told you, it is a spot of refreshment and peace for the weary ones who progress that way towards the uplands which lie beyond. In this chine there stands a large church. It is not of stately aspect, nor is it elaborate of design. but it is clean and comely, and within it the light is perpetual. This light proceeds from a large cross above the altar with which those are in contact who send their influence across the hills from the colonies on the other side. In this way the interior is illuminated, not equally, for there are patches of shadow at the west end, as you would call it, and, here and there, some alcove where those spirits who are still unaccustomed to so much radiance even as this may retire for meditation and prayer until they become strong enough to join the general congregation. There are no aisles, it is all one large, open space except for the niches, or alcoves, of which I have spoken. P48 There is a chancel raised a little above the nave and, in the nave itself, some few yards from the south side of the chancel arch, stands a roomy pulpit. There is little more furniture in the church. No organ? No, my friend. No music is possible on that side of the hills, conditions do not admit of that. You may see for yourself some day. Music is of harmony and well-poised vibration. That region is not so far advanced as to provide vibrations of such a character as is required for the production of music. Nor do the congregation sing. It has been tried a few times when some minister had charge of the proceedings who was one of the more progressed, one of the inhabitants of that region. But the result was a failure. They did their best, poor things. But the discord was painful, even to some of the dull-sensed company. So singing is rarely attempted now. The church is used for instruction and an elementary effort after worship, but teaching is the main work which goes on there. That is found more helpful than anything else to those who meet from time to time to rest there from their toiling, and to receive refreshment to enable them to go forth again in their endeavor to progress away from the darkness toward the light. Ask your question. Or, do not trouble. I see you hesitate, and I know what is in your mind. The answer is, yes, you have helped there yourself on more than one occasion. I can only think of one instance which might be one to which you refer. That was in my sleep time. In your body's sleep time. You do not sleep. You have been there several times, but the memory faded on your return to earth consciousness. Do you remember, when you awoke one morning, hearing a long-drawn, weird and wailing Amen? Yes, I shall never forget the awful hopelessness of that Amen. That was a second instance. I can well enter into your description of it. But had you heard some of the sounds which torment the ear in the deeper hells, you would be able to detect in that Amen more than one ray of hope. Again, do you remember a friend writing to you to say she had met with a minister on one of her journeys into those grey lands? Yes. You were there at work when she saw you. That makes three times. On the occasion first referred to, I was in the pulpit teaching them the truth about the Apostles' Creed, I remember. But the whole church was in gloom except for a few yards around the pulpit. Yet you say the light in that church is perpetual. On that occasion the light from the altar was shaded, or, more properly speaking, suppressed, for the time being, so that the congregation might be the less distracted from you and your teaching. Nor was it re-illumined for some time after you had been called away again, or that would have driven much of your sermon from their minds. They are of so feeble a character that it is necessary to deal most carefully with them, so frail are they in their hold on anything elevating. So the church was kept in semi-darkness until they had dispersed. At certain rare intervals those who are ready to make their journey through the gate into the uplands beyond are brought together there. Then the building is illuminated to its full capacity, and one from a higher sphere comes and stands in the chancel, and his own native light helps the brightness of the place. He speaks to them lovingly and helpfully, and they get their first glimpse of what the people are like who live beyond the hills, and among whom they themselves will one day be numbered. The beauty of such a visitor is a great joy to them, and they gaze on his form as if he were a god, instead of an angel from one of the lower heavens. Sometimes the angel is of one sex, sometimes of the other, according to the company that assembled, and the nature of the work in hand. If the majority are women, the angel is usually one of the mothers who have charge of the rest houses, or the children's homes. On these occasions, as on all in that church, proceedings are quite informal. There is no ritual there, and speaking on the part of the congregation is not only permitted but encouraged. Especially are they enticed to ask questions. methods have to be adopted to the low status of those who form the assembly. At our next meeting, I wish to tell you of one of these services. It is with that intent I have given you this description tonight. Friday, February 7th, 1919. 5.45 to 7.20 p.m. The congregation was a larger one than usual, for word had gone forth that there would be present no less than 3 visitors from beyond the hills. I will describe the service briefly. It will give you an idea of what is the highest form of spiritual exercise in that drear land. Before the altar stood an old, venerable-looking man. His beard was white, and reached to the girdle encircling his long robe of a color which I would describe as deep green color. That is as it appeared to the audience. None of the visitors, as they manifest themselves in those regions, are seen by the inhabitants in their normal condition, either as to form, features or clothing. You must bear in mind that the account I now give you is from the viewpoint of the congregation, as they saw things, as they were meant to see them. P52 to the rear of him, on the north side of the altar, stood a young woman, in garments of like material and, over them, a mantle. Similarly attired was another woman, a little older, who stood on the south side of the altar. On the altar itself stood a model of a dwelling house. The missioner, by which name we will call the old man, spoke to the congregation in this wise: "You may be glad, my children, that you have so far progressed as to be able to come together like this to meet us who have journeyed from beyond the gate. You are not so far from that gate yourselves at this moment, and, when you have worked a little longer, and are able to remain in such nearness permanently, then we will see if it is not possible to lead you through to the other side. Meanwhile, I have a few rather interesting things to show you. I brought them with me for that purpose, so that you would be able to picture for yourselves, to a certain degree, what life is like there. I can assure you it is well worth working for, very well worth it. Even just a short journey from the gate, the people have houses like this, and, mark you, many of those people have come, not direct from earth life, but from this land where you now live. This is not a very happy country to live in, is it? Ah well, never mind that, live in the future, and you will soon be able to go yonder and, after a time, to come back and help your mates whom you have left behind. Now, isn't that worth a bit of patience and endeavor?" "Yes, it is," shouted out a man in the congregation. "Damn well worth it, too," added another, more enthusiastic. "Very well," continued the missioner. "Now, that's the sentiment I want to see universal among you, unanimous. I'll tell you why. Those two brothers have shown by their words a very decided streak of altruism. Now, there must be some here who remember what altruism means." There was a pause of silence when this invitation was given, while the audience did a very strenuous bit of mental exercise. Now let me digress here a little in order to explain. Many in that crowd, when in the earth life, were men and women, not only of refined tastes, but of considerable culture. Let me tell you a few who may, or may not, have been there on that occasion, but whom I knew as inhabitants of that region, and who have been, from time to time, to one of the gatherings held in that church. Some have now progressed, others are there still. Here is a short list: a financier who dealt with millions sterling, a colonel of cavalry, with a country seat ancient and beautiful, a doctor of divinity, 3 doctors of medicine, a lady who had a fine mansion a few miles out of town, and whose townhouse was the center of politics and art. She was one of the leaders in a philanthropic effort to raise a fund for the building of a sanatorium for indigent society people, a millionaire who left many large bequests to charity, a number of lesser lights in earth life, but intelligent, educated people. In addition to these, rulers and princes are there, and legislators, some still remembered and honored by the people of earth. To such as these the missioner spoke in simple terms such as would be suited to a Sunday school class of junior children, and yet keeping in mind ever as he spoke, the experiences through which they had passed. The truth is these people had, while on earth, spent their time in assimilating the wrong kind of knowledge, or knowledge employed in wrong ways, or from wrong motives. Their refinement also had been outward and not spiritual refinement, which is saintliness. The consequence was that when they cast off their earth bodies and came over here, they found themselves as little children in real knowledge, for they had to begin to unlearn nearly all they had counted worth knowing, in body weakly and unsightly, and in mental endowment bemused and bewildered. P54 When they had somewhat recovered from their initial perplexity, some were of such strong character that they were able to do one of two things, according to their choice, either to face the situation honestly and admit their errors with more or less humility, or to adopt an attitude of defiance, and deliberately set themselves to become great and evil. These latter eventually become the rulers of the dark regions. As told in the part 2-3 in the book A Wanderer in the Spirit Lands of Franchezzo, taken down through A. Farnese Ficar 120 years ago link, those who choose more wisely, are helped in their endeavor to banish what store of knowledge they have into the background of their minds, until, having progressed sufficiently to be beyond the probability of backsliding, they are gradually encouraged to bring it forth again, viewed now in right perspective and motive. There are, however, no cast iron rules in the matter. Everyone is endowed with free will, which is never taken away, and, if there will be free, you cannot bind it by rules and regulations. What I have given you above, therefore, is the general condition of affairs in which, from time to time, exceptional cases arise and set all precedents awry. When the missioner mentioned the word altruism, he was applying this principle to his hearers. The word lay in the back of the brains of not a few, but, between it and the present moment, there lay a whole series of bitter experiences in the hells, which had obliterated their earth life from their memories, for there is no altruism in the deeper hells. Now it was being called forth, here and there a little, and not so much or so vividly as to create a danger of relapse, very real danger at that stage of progress, and a difficulty perpetually present in the mind of those who work among them. To return to the church, one arose and, with an air of pride, gave an explanation of the word. The missioner took it up and skillfully used it in his teaching. Then he pointed to the model of the house of which he had spoken previously, and which was standing upon the altar. He told them that the house was such as they would inhabit when they had made the next stage of their journey toward the land of brightness. There were many homes like it, some already completed, others nearing completion, and which would be ready before his hearers were, so that they would be able to take up their abode in them when they arrived. "Who builds them?" cried one of his hearers. This was what the speaker had been angling for, and immediately he seized his opportunity. "Well," he said, "there are several classes of people who build those houses. But the delightful thing about it all is that they do not build them for themselves. They have their own houses to live in, and, between their other regular duties, they employ their spare time in erecting these for you." That is really what came to my mind when the brother yonder uttered his exclamation. These builders find some of their greatest pleasure in that same altruism, as these houses bear witness. The longer they live in their bright land, the more they realize the pleasure of doing something for others who, as they know, will not be able to repay them. Of course, I need hardly mention who it was who taught that, both by his life and words. So these friends come towards your country, until they arrive beyond the gate there, and there they do a spell of building, and return home, to come again when they have a bit of leisure. Damn good sort they must be, too," cried out the enthusiast who had spoken before. He stood up to make his remark the more emphatic. Just in front of him was a woman who had not lost her veneer of affected Puritanism. She turned, looked at him and very markedly turned back again and settled herself down, with a shrug of the shoulders which was very significant of her disdain. P57 The man, who was bubbling over with eagerness, had looked at her with a delighted grin upon his face, expecting her approbation. But he saw her disgust and, in doubt as to what had happened, looked from her to the missioner, like a perplexed schoolboy, his smile becoming uncertain, and then flickering away. Seeing the whole episode, the missioner said, "I fear, my friend, you were rather emphatic, and that lady was a wee bit startled. Your words were somewhat spontaneous, weren't they? But the sentiment itself was such as to do you credit. I would like to talk it over with you after our meeting, if you will walk a little way with me toward the gate as I return. You will not be able to go very far, I think. We shall see, anyway. But I do think you will be able to go farther than you have done before. And I am wondering if I might not perhaps manage to show you just a glimpse of those houses in the distance.